welcome to the August 2020 edition of Outward. I'm Christina Cotarucci, a staff writer at Slate, and I would like to commend everyone on the internet making memes about Kamala Harris, the Democratic vice presidential nominee, as Bette Porter. And I've decided that this is going to be my version of imagining an audience in their underwear to get over stage fright. Just every time I see Joe Biden in the news or making a speech, I'm going to imagine him as Tina Kennard. And that's going to make this terrible, wretched campaign cycle a lot more bearable for me.
Oh my God. I love that so much, especially because Bette Porter is the patron saint of our show.
Totally.
Of course. That's wonderful.
I like that get out the vote strategy, Christina.
It's motivating to me.
I'm Ramon Alam. I'm one of Slate's Care and Feeding columnists, and I'm a dad. So August usually promises, yay, the kids are heading back to school. And that has been replaced by a sense of creeping dread about Zoom lessons and Google Classroom. But it's just that's the kind of moment we're in.
Yeah. I'm Brian Lauder, editor of Outward, and today is a good day because I just got a surprise package of drag from one of my fairy friends. I'm going to show it. The listeners won't be able to see it, but look at this emerald.
Oh, wow. Green, what is
fairy
that?
Sparkling gown. It's like a full
gown. Oh, my
gown.
God. That's gorgeous.
Like full-length floor gown, zip up. I cannot wait.
As my dad would say every time I bought a new item of clothing in high school, are you going to wear a tank top under that? Because it's see-through.
It is see-through. No, and I probably won't. I probably won't. Christina's dad. I'm sorry. But no, it's such a delight. So that's
beautiful.
A nice thing to get on an August day. Yeah.
It looks perfect for the weather, too. Nice and breathable.
Super.
This month on Outward, we are going to be joined by our fellow Slate columnist, Rich Joswiak. Rich is one of the columnists on How to Do It, Slate's sex advice column. And we are going to pepper him with all of our sex quarantine questions. I'm very excited about that. It seems like a perfect hot topic for the hottest month of the year. And we're also going to spend some time on another hot topic, hot in a different way, a less hot in a less scintillating way, which is whatever is happening in the current moment with Ellen DeGeneres, the, you know, arguably this country's most well-known gay personality, is embroiled in a workplace scandal. And we'll talk about Ellen and her legacy and what that show, less about the controversy on that show, but more about Ellen's place in the American culture. But before we get to that, we will talk, as we always do at the beginning of these shows, about our pride and provocations. Brian, how are you feeling this month? Are you feeling proud or are you feeling provoked?
I'm feeling proud. I'm generally feeling proud about how I've been seeing our queer spaces like bars and clubs trying to adapt to the moment of some reopening here in New York with really inventive ways of doing that safely. But I wanted to call out one space in particular that I recently visited and had just the most fantastic, revivifying time. It's called Elsewhere, and it's in sort of Ridgewood neighborhood of Queens. And before the pandemic, it was an amazing queer, mostly queer nightclub space. It had been there many times for that kind of thing. And of course, now they can't do that anymore, but they do have a roof deck. And they have turned that into a really fantastic space to socially distant, everything safe, but to be around queer people again. And we went, my partners and I went the other Friday night a week or so ago, and you had to get like a reservation to be sure that you know there was a table. You had to stay at your table unless you were masked and going up to collect your food items. They'd invented this whole like ordering system so that it was touchless. They did the temperature checks and the hand sanitizers and all of that in just the most efficient, excellent way. And then when you got there, you got to feel like you were almost at a gay club again. And just being around all the queer people that were there made me so happy. So feeling proud of our spaces who are trying to figure this out and, you know, hoping that more can do it and survive, because we're going to need them for sure.
I too am proud this month. I am proud of some of our fellow queers and allies in the WNBA. So earlier this month, WNBA players from several teams started wearing t-shirts that said "Vote Warnock" as they arrived to play their games. So Reverend Warnock is a Democrat who's running against Georgia Senator Kelly Loeffler. You might know her as the Republican who was famously investigated for insider trading when she allegedly attempted to profit off the coronavirus crisis. She just happens to own 49% of the Dream, which is Atlanta's WNBA team. And the WNBA has dedicated its season to Black women who've been killed by police. Every game is dedicated to one such woman. Meanwhile, Senator Loeffler has been criticizing the movement for Black lives, dog whistling, calling protesters a mob, saying that Black Lives Matter protesters are encouraging destruction. So WNBA players have called for Loeffler to be ousted as a team owner. The WNBA leadership isn't doing that. So players, led by noted queermo Sue Bird, decided to campaign to get her out of the Senate, including the players on her team, on the team that she owns. I think it's incredibly brave, and it is putting all team owners on notice. I don't know how much you guys know about sports. I know very little, but what I do know is that there has been a sort of accepted dynamic for a long time, for forever, whereby team owners can really constrain what their players are able to do in terms of, you know, what they wear, what they say, who they talk to. And in an industry where the owners are largely white, the players are largely Black, there's always been a racialized dynamic. And watching Black players, Laisha Clarendon is another one who's been taking the lead on WNBA activism this season, another noted queermo. Watching these people step up, have this incredible solidarity among the teams in a way that you really don't see among men's leagues. They're not engaging in this sort of theater of rivalry. They're all standing together against this really embarrassing team owner. Is so heartening, and I can't imagine a better way for players to be using their time and their freedom of speech at this moment.
It's really, really gutsy, and it's amazing to watch, because the attempt, like sort of like the political attempt there, is to shame somebody who is really sort of shameless, right? Like, power is so unshameable, but this is so shameful to look at. Like, It's very powerful to think that, like, the people who are ultimately in this woman's employ are saying very openly that they are ashamed of her, or that we all ought to be. It's a really powerful statement, and I also find some vicarious pride in it, and I'm not like a sports person at all.
And I also love that it's a proactive message. It's not just get this woman out of the WNBA. It's vote for her opponent.
Yeah.
And, you know, he is trailing her and the other conservative who's running right now. But, and, you know, who knows? There's still a lot of fundraising and get out the vote work to do. And besides that, I just love the example that it's setting for even other workers to be able to organize against bosses who are, you know, disrespecting their lives and livelihoods.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm glad that you two are both feeling proud this moment, because I am feeling sort of provoked. Last month on this show, we spoke to the journalist David France about his documentary Welcome to Chechnya, which talks about the oppression of LGBTQ citizens inside of Russia. It was such a sobering and educational experience for me, and I'm provoked watching what's happening in the country of Poland right now. Andrzej Duda, the president of Poland, is a populist leader. He just won re-election, in part by demonizing that country's LGBTQ populace. Like, this is just sort of from that same nationalist playbook. A couple of days ago, the arrest of an activist named Margot Sutovich led to a spontaneous protest during which 48 people were detained. It's a really frightening situation. And I think David France's film reminded me personally that we need to be aware of what's happening both here and abroad, that we need to be conscious of it and we need to allow ourselves to be provoked by the politics in other countries.
And I think that's so true, what you said about it being this nationalist playbook. I mean, it's something that is pulled from again and again and could be pulled from here. You know, like it is just very much present in that discourse. And I think, you know, our community, among others, is usually one of the first up to get deployed in this way and abused in this way. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's frightening.
It's also yet another reminder that, you know, the arc of progress is not inevitable and it's not really an arc at all. You know, it's like a squiggle line. And that, you know, whenever I hear people like Joe Biden, for instance, aka Tina Kennard, talk about, you know, well, the more you meet gay people, the more you like them, or like, more and more people are just understanding, like, that's not actually how people work. It's not how politics work, and it's not how movements work. And if anything is going to, if queer people and trans people are going to be protected, it needs a sustained and organized effort behind it. It doesn't just happen. You know, it's not like there's just some wave of tolerance and justice sweeping the world that will eventually be inhaled by people in every country.
Well, yeah, let's hope that there is, but there isn't at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. You've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. The show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
Let's talk about an entirely different kind of provocation now. Very, very excited to talk to Rich Jesbiak, our colleague, about sex in this particular moment of quarantine.
All right. So August means that we are 6 months, that is half of a year, into the coronavirus pandemic. At the beginning of all of this, it was easy to understand why casual sex and dating and romantic lives generally needed to be locked down along with everything else. But as we've moved into the era of phased reopenings, quarantine bubbles, and public health departments advocating the use of glory holes, guidance on how to conduct our intimate lives during COVID has become a little bit confusing. So to help us sort it out, we've called in Rich Jesbiak, one of Slate's How to Do It sex advice columnists and one of my favorite writers on queer issues generally. Thanks so much for joining us today, Rich.
Thank you for having me and for saying that.
Sure thing. So as an advice columnist, you've got this, I think, broad view of what life is out there, like out there for people, more so than most of us. So what's your just general sense about how people are holding up in terms of their sex and romantic lives right now?
It seems fraught. There's not a ton of pure data, but anecdotally, I think that people at this point, if they are continuing to socially distance with the rigorousness that they were at the start of the pandemic, are basically at the end of their rope. But I think a lot of people aren't being as strict as they were. I mean, that's what it seems like. I can't say that for sure, but just anecdotally, it seems like people are just being less strict.
Have you read messages from people who are taking incremental steps to reopening their sex lives?
So it seems like people are sort of like, you know, keeping in pods or closed circles but see, the problem that I think there is with this is if you're starting this out, you know, if you're like, okay, I found somebody on an app that I'm going to hook up with, and that's going to be my quarantine person. How many app relationships, you know, endure for any period of time anyway. I feel like that sort of that you're setting yourself on a pattern of behavior where you're going to have a new quarantine buddy every few weeks, you know, if that, you know. So I don't really trust that as a method per se. But at this point, I'm not really judging people who do that because I understand that, you know, along with the imperative of keeping ourselves physically safe, there is the imperative to keep ourselves mentally safe and happy.
I wonder, Rich, if you've heard from your readers any kind of solutions to that that you found inventive or interesting, if you've heard from people saying like, well, this is what I've done and this is how I've got through this tough period.
So generally, like, you know, the people, it's like a problem on top of a problem, right? So like, nobody is particularly inventive. They're asking us to invent for them. And
solve our problem, Rich.
Exactly. And so in sort of that arena, a lot of people have written in about like virtual sex or screen sex. And a lot of people who write in are like, I don't like this. And my partner is, you know, across the country. What should I do? And it's like, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that you don't like. You know, no one person can like everything. And a lot of us like a relatively small number of things. So I just try to remind people that, like, this is what you got. If you don't like it, you don't have to do it. But it's basically what you're working with. I personally don't like phone sex or virtual sex or screen sex or any of that, really. I'd rather watch porn. No offense to partners. I mean, it's the same thing. And then in porn, it's like two people and not just one person on a screen. I don't find that experience like gratifying whatsoever. So I'm also a terrible person to ask, or like, how do I talk sexy? I don't know. Sex is a refuge from having to talk. I talk all the time. I write all the time. I talk in my head. Sex is like the one time I get to not talk. That's what I like about it. So I can't help you with
that. It also feels like a very particular preference related thing. Like, one person's sexy talk is another person's like incredible turn off. My most optimistic self wonders if this moment will introduce people to new things that they like that they might not have had the impetus to try before. You know, like, oh, I've never had to really embrace talking dirty or having Zoom sex with somebody, or, you know, Google chat sex or whatever. I'm not loyal to anyone platform.
It seems like masks are going to have to be fetishized.
Oh my God, yes.
For more people.
It's already happening for me.
I've noticed, yeah. Like, I think maybe we've even talked about this, like, people are like learning how to cruise again with their eyes, like in a way that I haven't seen in a really long time. And it's like suddenly you don't have anything else, so all you can do is kind of do this. And like the eye contact has gotten spicy, like out there, and it's great. I mean, am I in the 70s again or something? But like that's really exciting, I guess. It's for a sad reason, I guess. But like that's happening.
This is not sexual at all, but. The other day, I had a very heartening experience. I was meeting a friend, actually a coworker at Slate, to have breakfast in the park together. And the coworker got there early and she saw another queer person who she thought was me from afar. So she went over and started talking to them. Then I arrived and was like, oh, you found a friend. And she's like, no, I don't know this person. I just thought it was you. And then that person and I realized we live in the same neighborhood and exchanged numbers. Like, oh, maybe now we'll be friends. And I went
now
home.
Now you're in a quarantine bubble.
Not yet. In fact, check back in 2 months. We might be mortal enemies. I don't know. But I was like, oh, let me... My wife, I was like, I met this new person who might be our new friend. Went to look them up on Facebook. And I was like, is that them? I don't know. Like, I don't know what their face looks like because they were behind. Like, I probably wouldn't even recognize them if I saw them on the street somewhere. It's like, and yet we met, you know? It's like a totally different way of trying to assess a new person. It's so much is hidden from us. It is exciting.
And Christina, to your point about trying new things, within the sort of limited data that is out there, I talked to one of my regular sources, this guy, Justin Laymiller, who wrote a book called Tell Me What You Want, which was about fantasies. And he works with the Kinsey Institute. And so they did a study at the beginning, pretty much the beginning of lockdown. I think the study began like March 15th and lasted about a month or so. And it was over 1,500 people that completed it. And while the study found that a lot of the majority of people's sex lives, the majority of people reported that their sex lives had declined or just the quality of them had declined. Those who the very small minority, about 13.6% of people who said it improved, what was linked to that was trying something new. You know, what and that's often by necessity. And sometimes it could be something as simple as sexting. People said, I never sexted before, now I'm sexting. So it does seem like there is a correlative quality with trying something new and that making people happier, which I think makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that true generally too, that, you know, novelty is sort of the spice of life?
Totally.
Well, so speaking of novelty, Rich, I wonder what you're hearing from people who are in a period of lockdown with a partner. And, you know, they're not, I'm mindful of my friends who are single and are home alone and are really feeling like that's a particular kind of not even leaving sex aside, that's a sort of psychologically difficult thing to endure. Just, you know, being cut off from human company for a period of time. It's not natural. It's not healthy. But I'm doing this with my husband. Like, we're sort of in it together with our kids sort of ruining the intimacy there. But like, are you hearing from, like, what are you hearing or what are you seeing in the letters that you're reading about people? Are people feeling trapped or stuck, or are people feeling like it's an opportunity to kind of reinvent how the relationship functions?
Well, both. We get a lot of stuff that's like, how do I have sex in my small apartment with my child here? Or, you know, where I'm staying at my partner's parents with him and it's a small place. What do we do? And I'm like, a lot of the times, I don't know. What do you do? But we did get this week, in fact, recently, we got a question that is, you know, as out there as they come. I can read it to you if you'd like.
Please,
it's not very long. It's pretty wild. So my wife and I like to do the cuckold scene, but during COVID, it's just the two of us. So we have been playing some Dom sub games. Right now, she is making me masturbate 1 to 2 times a day into a Ziploc bag and immediately freezing it. After a week, I have to eat it all. So my question is, assuming I'm STI-free, tested and true, is there anything I need to worry about with my cumsicle? If we don't hear from you by cumsicle day, we will just continue adding to the prize as we want to be safe. Thanks.
Like, coronavirus-wise? Like, he was afraid about eating his own cum because it might have coronavirus in it?
I interpreted this as like he was afraid that somehow freezing it would change its constitution to such a point that it would become dangerous. I don't know. That didn't really scan for me. I mean, I took the question seriously, as I always do.
It's kind of
and there is, you know, you can be allergic to your own cum. That's a thing. Yeah, so, yes. I read a really crazy horror story about, like, 3 days worth of diarrhea after a guy did this very thing on Reddit. Unfortunately and fortunately, there's Reddit, because this is something that is not well studied at all. But it is, I mean, like, I was aware of this practice, having, like, spent time on tube sites. Mm-hmm. I knew that this was a thing that people did for a variety of reasons. And Reddit just happens to be a fountain of information on cumsicles. Mm. Yeah, so there's an example of novelty.
That's novel. That's absolutely yes. Novel. Oh my God.
The New York City Health Department put out sort of a guide to safer sex during quarantine. And they were encouraging people to experiment with barriers, which we took to mean use glory holes if and when that's possible. Have you heard from people trying to engage those kinds of safer sex measures?
I have not. I wonder about, I was a little bit surprised because very early on it was reported that COVID was found in semen. So, but that transmission was unknown. I don't know. I got a similar question this week about going down on a woman, or like whether, you know, vaginal fluid or just the canal is, you know, a means of transmission. And it seems like, no, there's just a few studies. None have found, people have not found this yet, that there's fluid, that there's COVID in vaginal fluid. But I don't know. I don't understand in those situations, unless you have like an outdoor glory hole situation. Yeah. I mean,
right.
We still understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, you breathe. And isn't that the main way of transmission? Right. So I don't understand how you could. So that's what basically I said to the person who wrote in, that was like, how are you ever going to be able to say definitively, oh, I got this through oral sex, and not just by being right. next
like
to you because you had COVID and you're
actually
breathing.
Very close to exactly. where their vagina is.
Exactly. Exactly. It's not 6 feet away unless, you know, we're talking about an Amazon. So, yeah, I don't really, the health department, look, I'm all for glory holes. Great. Bring back the glory hole. It seemed like somewhat convoluted advice to me, but again, do what you have to. If that's your risk reduction, great. Use a glory hole.
Yeah, I do. I wonder, and this is pure speculation on my part, but I'm trying to imagine the person who feels comfortable enough or desperate enough to take a risk to have sex with somebody, but not so much that you would just have sex normally, that, you know, you're going to be taking these
sort of
halfway measures that are, who knows how well they'll even work.
Exactly. Yeah, it's sort of mystifying to me as well.
But listeners, if you're one of those people, you know, we would love to hear of that experience. You can email us at outwardpodcast@slate.com.
Oh, please let us know. Yeah, we will read it. So there's a lot of talk about when normal will come back, or if normal will come back. I want after the pandemic. I wonder what your general thinking is on that, Rich. Will sort of the way that we hooked up and dated before this return one day, or is this going to change things in some ways forever? What's your prognostication?
I don't know. Anecdotally, it seems like for a lot of people, it is back to what it used to be. Maybe not as promiscuous, you know, as it could be or whatever, but promiscuous enough. So I think certain people will be necessarily more careful and more reluctant to go out there and do it. And I think some people will, you know, plow through it as they have been the entire pandemic. I mean, I am aware of people who just never socially distanced, who just never did that. And, you know, they've never, you know, it's turned out to have been fine for them. So why would they? You know, I think a lot of people have that attitude, and I think a lot of people aren't sharing that attitude. So I mean, I don't know. I guess we'll see. I think we're in New York, we're in the midst of a weird turn where it seems like we did what we had to. And in fact, it almost seems like we are living in a harm reduction world, you know? It's a different city than it was in March, you know? It's already different, and we're not seeing increase in cases or deaths. So we're being given evidence that, like, maybe we don't need to go whole hog, you know? I don't know, but, I think that where there's a will, there's a way, and there's going to be people having sex.
When you were saying, you know, that some people have not socially distanced, have just continued as normal, and it's been fine for them, I think when I hear that, I am reminded of the people you spoke of who are shaming people on social media for going to parties or having sex or whatever. And I think there is a sense among a lot of people that this isn't, it's not like the usual kind of moralizing where, like, you're injecting yourself into somebody else's business, because you can tell yourself, like, hey, there are asymptomatic people spreading it all over the place, and maybe you didn't get sick or didn't know you were sick, but you spread it to somebody else who did get really sick and you didn't even know it. So I think there's a sense of people wanting certainty where there is none, and also feeling like this is very much a community safety issue and not like a to each their own kind of issue, which makes it so much different than any other conversation about sex that we could have or that the queer community has had.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And I say that not, you know, I mentioned people who do that not to hold that up as a model of behavior that I'm suggesting, but merely to say that they've done this, they haven't experienced any firsthand illness, any firsthand, you know, liability as a result of it. And so they haven't learned, you know, sometimes it takes, you know, actual consequences for people to change their behavior. And I think a lot of people have been shown inadvertently that they don't have to. What does that mean? You know, say they're carrying around immunity. What does that mean for next year for them? Who knows? I don't know. But I think I really do believe that people will find a way to have sex.
Yeah.
I really do.
That's a safe bet.
Yeah. Well, I think in times as uncertain as these, that is a certainty we can hold on to. I think that's a great place to leave it. Rich, thank you so much for joining us and for your amazing advice.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can go read Rich every week on how to do it in slate.com.
All right, our next topic for the month, Ellen DeGeneres. You might have heard of her. Last month, BuzzFeed published two articles from Christy Lee Yandley about the working conditions at Ellen DeGeneres' talk show. According to several former employees, BuzzFeed reported, workers have been subjected to racist comments, sexual harassment at the hands of multiple producers, and general mistreatment by producers. Some former employees said that DeGeneres knew what was happening and didn't do anything to stop it. Others have said that Ellen herself was a mean boss. So June Thomas, a lesbian icon in her own right, we had a little chat about what to make of these revelations about Ellen DeGeneres. You can find that transcript on slate.com. And one of the major questions that we had was, will this episode affect how Ellen is perceived by mainstream straight America, which is home to the vast majority of her fans? I actually don't know any queer people who are diehard fans of the Ellen talk show. So Ellen was blacklisted in Hollywood for many years after she came out. And an essential part of her re-entry into the good graces of the industry was this persona she had that features heavily on the show, this inoffensive, exceedingly generous, super kind, you know, America's best lesbian friend kind of character. So what I'm wondering is that image and by extension, Ellen's ability to be embraced by straight America under threat now? Has this changed America's perception of her in any meaningful way? What do you guys think?
I think it's a challenge to untangle whether Ellen herself is being held to a higher standard because she's a woman, maybe, or because she is queer, and that there's an expectation that, like, she as the big boss, like, the buck stopped with her, that we would have with her that we might not have with, you know, say, Jimmy Kimmel or David Letterman or Jimmy Fallon, right? So I think that's one thing. And I think the other thing is that in a way, you can look at Ellen, the rumors of Ellen being an imperious boss as a kind of victory that, like, yes, she should be an imperious boss because men have been able to handle power and celebrity that way for a long period of time. And in a perverse way, you can say, isn't that kind of great that Ellen has access to the privilege that we are more comfortable affording to celebrated men?
I think of that argument in the same way that I think of arguments about Amy Klobuchar when there were reports of her, you know, berating employees, throwing things at them. And there was a little bit of a strain of argument out there that was like, well, good for her. She didn't, you know, women don't get places in politics without having sharp elbows and without, you know, throwing a few staplers. Yeah. And I think that's the completely wrong way to look at it. I think
we should want no one to be doing this.
Exactly.
Yes.
The motivation of, you know, any work that we have done for equality should be to raise the bar for everybody else instead of lower the bar for somebody like Ellen. That said, I cannot picture anybody else being held to account for the behavior of all of their employees. I can't picture, you know, let's say, I'm trying to think of all of these men, and I'm just keep coming up with like Charlie Rose, no, Matt Lauer, no, like
well,
what men host shows,
right? Jimmy Fallon, like sweet Jimmy Fallon, right? Like there's a way in which even I am like, well, on the Ellen DeGeneres show, like Ellen must be the mom, right? Like everybody must be accountable to her because she's. And is that by virtue of the fact that she's a woman? Whereas if this were happening, and to be clear, it's not happening as far as I know, but if this were happening with Jimmy Fallon's show, would he be able to say like, well, I'm just the boss. Like, I don't know what's happening. I don't understand how these other interpersonal relationships are playing out under the umbrella of my personality and my persona. Like, you know, is it different? Is our expectation different because she is a woman? I don't know if it is necessarily, but I think that in part it might be.
I think it might be that. I also, though, think that she cultivated this persona of the you know, generous, kind, inoffensive, sort of best friend very consciously, like, from the get with her career. And I feel like what's happening now is that of, like, if you believed that was like 100% true, maybe you feel betrayed now. But if you were like savvy and knew it was kind of a performance, then you feel like, I feel a kind of like, not that it's like justified, but just like, well, that was always fake. And of course it's going to come back to bite you. Right. But then on the other hand, like, I feel sad that she felt that she had to construct that persona in the first place to be accepted as a queer person. Right. So it's like this thicket. I'm not even sure if I'm explaining it clearly, but like I see why she had to create that brand, even as I kind of hate the brand and feel like the brand itself is like offensive. I don't know.
I mean, I think that it's just so clear to me that Ellen, or really any of the performers we're talking about, are conducting a performance. And there's a particular nuance to the nature of Ellen's performance by the fact that she is a butch lesbian, right, who came out in a very public way and was really kind of destroyed for it for a long period of time. And so we assume that her performance of geniality is somehow a correction for what she went through in that period of time. But we don't really know that. She could simply be playing nice because it earns her tens of millions of dollars a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a simple and straightforward calculation. And I think it's very hard to understand how insulating and warping it can be to possess that kind of money and that kind of celebrity where you just don't... Your sense of who you are and what your responsibility is to other people becomes very confused and very odd, and you are indulged, your own idiosyncrasy is indulged, and you are protected. And so, in a way, you can't blame somebody who is as cosseted as Ellen is for an abdication of leadership, because she has been, to get that kind of money, to occupy that kind of celebrity, is to kind of be babied.
Well, it's such a strange position because she is, I mean, coming out the way that she did in 97, like, trailblazer is the right word. At the same time, if you don't build on that into sort of a politics, then where does that leave, like, the community looking at you, right? Like, I feel like that's where I'm at a loss with her generally, is, like, I recognize that it was, you know, career suicide to do that, or seemed to be, to do what she did. But then, like, props for that, I guess. But then, like, what did you do after? And, like, you, Christina, in your chat with June, you had this great line about, like, I think you were quoting, or sort of paraphrasing Barack Obama, who said that she pushed the country in the direction of justice. And you asked, like, is she still doing that? Or how long has it been since she was doing that? And, like, I don't think at all, as far as I know, like, she's not someone who comes to mind when I think about queer people who are pushing the boundaries of what, you know, of justice for all of us.
Except for, I mean, I would point out, though, the simple act of representation on the television screens of millions of Americans daily.
But do you, so that's interesting. Like, but do you think, is the representation that she offers, like, this sounds weird, but like enough of a representation? Like, is it like, I mean, this gets into like a kind of lesbian enough thing, you know, like kind of test, which I am, you know, suspicious of, but like at the same time, you know, I should say, like, I don't watch the show, but like my sense from clips and things that I see is not that it's like a super queer show. So like,
yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember that we're talking about a network morning show, right? Like, it is to call it G-rated is an understatement, right? Like, the endeavor of the program is to, you know, entertain an audience, I would guess, that it's largely women who make their living in the home, right? Who make their lives in the home. And you know, and again, I don't know the demographics of Ellen's viewership. I don't know who is tuning in. But my guess is that it is, for some segment of Ellen's audience, she is the gay person who they know.
Yes.
And that they have a feeling about her. They have an attachment to her. They have an understanding of her and her home life with the actress Portia de Rossi. And like there's some power in that. That may actually have affected how a whole population thinks about gay and lesbian people more generally. I don't know. I don't know if that's giving her too much credit or if that's misunderstanding who her audience actually is, but that's my guess. And I think that, you know, I don't want to pretend that there's not power in that.
My question about that is, you know, less about the actual, whether her show is sort of queer enough or political enough, because it's never going to be queer enough or political enough for me. My question is more, does that positive representational effect still have the same meaning, you know, 15 years since the show's beginning?
Yeah.
I think it was probably a lot more powerful 7 years ago than it is now, when there are all manner of queer people in all manner of mainstream entertainment, you know. So while she may be the only queer person that some people know, still, they've known her for 15 years. And I wonder if those people have progressed at all in their understanding of what it means to be like an LGBTQ ally in that span of time, or whether they can just sort of think, you know, I'm not bigoted because I watch Ellen, in the same way that Oprah, being a famous and rich Black woman on TV, didn't solve people's racism. You know, I think there's a limit to how far that kind of representation can lift people up. Meanwhile, now Oprah's out here putting Breonna Taylor's picture on the cover of her magazine. Mm-hmm. You know, Beyonce is out here making a visual album full of, you know, artists from the African diaspora. What is Ellen doing for what sort of similar way is Ellen using her position as an arbiter of mainstream culture to advance the communities that she's a part of? I expect so little from her that I wasn't surprised to hear that her workplace was a total clusterfuck and that she was tolerating, you know, racism and sexual harassment, because like you said, Ruman, I mean, she is far more, I'm just going to, again, quote myself from my conversation with June, because I vomited so much onto the page for that, but she seems far more invested in the rich community than she is in the LGBTQ community.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I think money is a very, very corrupting and strange influence, and I think it's impossible, especially the kind of money that we're talking about. It warps your sense of who you are. And Ellen sort of ran afoul of leftist politics already by, you know, Instagramming herself at the Super Bowl. Was it the Super Bowl? Actually, maybe it wasn't the Super Bowl.
But
some sporting event.
Wasn't even football.
With, you know,
like, yeah, a sports
you know,
game.
With George W. Bush. And so leading people to question her sort of liberal bona fides because she was palling around with a Republican president. And, you know, I think that there were also critics who looked at that and said, yes, of course, money knows about money. Like, you have to think about Ellen as a multimillionaire and not as like a lesbian.
It's intersectionality.
Yeah. I mean, the intersection of whiteness
truly.
And and vast, vast wealth. Like, that's where Ellen sits. And she may perform a service to the cultural imagination by showing up on daytime television in sharply tailored suits. And she may have done something. But, Christina, as you say, perhaps those hearts and minds have been won already. Like, we're sort of talking about a kind of Will and Grace style representation of queerness, but like the culture has actually moved well past that at this point.
I just keep thinking back to the conversation that she had with Kevin Hart when he was tapped to host the Oscars, and then, you know, people resurfaced all of these terrible homophobic jokes that he had told in the past. And Ellen devoted a whole hour of her show to shaming the people who were hurt by those jokes, calling them haters, agreeing with him when he called them trolls, basically positioning Kevin Hart as the victim of all of these queer and trans people who were saying, you know, can you apologize for these things? I think to me that really showed where her loyalties lay. And, you know, when we talk about the value of having somebody like her, an androgynous, I wouldn't say butch necessarily, public figure, you know, coming into your home every morning, like, it matters what you do with that identity. And what she did was use her identity as a way to absolve somebody of their homophobia. And I think that's one of the worst ways that you could possibly use that identity, because then you're giving permission to all the straight people watching to say, oh, okay, so like, my homophobia wasn't really that bad, or maybe I apologized for it once and now I can stop thinking about it. And everybody who's trying to hold me to task is actually just trying to bring me down and ruin my brand partnership with Chase.
I mean, I have no particular feelings about Ellen either way, but I am mindful of what she accomplished on her sitcom, also called Ellen, in a very, very different moment in this culture. And I think it is worthy and important to continue for audiences to continue to push their entertainers and their cultural figures toward a higher standard. And I think that's really worthy. And I think it's, we don't need Ellen in quite the same way now, because we do have people like Frank Ocean, or we have, you know, Janet Mock. Like, we have these pop cultural figures who really represent and embody difference and, you know, the sort of spectrum of human existence very powerfully. And that's wonderful. And they are, but, you know, I also am mindful of the fact that in a way they are the descendant. They have taken the torch from Ellen's fingers, because Ellen, as a sort of dumb sitcom entertainer, did roll the dice and make a very particular personal political statement in a time when that was not palatable. And she really did suffer for that. I'm not worried about Ellen. She's got hundreds of millions of dollars. She could probably buy a country and sort of start her own religion if she wanted to. But I am mindful of what that was in a different cultural moment.
Yeah. And I do think that the people who are most likely to be upset by these allegations, demanding better from her, are not necessarily the same people who have been, you know, enamored by the Ellen personality and the sort of like heartwarming GoFundMe moments on her show.
And good for them. I mean, that anger about her and what she represents is righteous. And I think it is wonderful to see people holding power to account. You know, like, that is important. And we exist in a cultural moment. Like, so people who panic refer to this as cancel culture, but that's not the moment. We exist in a moment of responsibility, right? And like, power should have to accept responsibility for the ways in which it is discharged. And that's a wonderful thing. And that is a welcome change in our expectations for people like Ellen, like our politicians, like anybody who possesses power.
And I think we can do that holding to account and keep in our minds at the same time that all of the, you know, the import of what she did, you know, we shouldn't erase that. But at the same time, we should be able to critique, not, you know, both what she's done with her sort of queer power and then also what's going on with these specific allegations now.
All right. That feels like a good place to end it. Listeners, I would love to hear from you if you're a fan of Ellen or if you have thoughts about what she's done with her queer power, as Brian so eloquently put it. You can email us anytime, day or night, at outwardpodcast@slate.com. All right, I guess it's time for our gay agenda. Brian, what are you bringing to us?
So, I am bringing to you this wonderful web series that I hope our listeners are already familiar with, but if not, I'm going to tell them about it, because that's what we do on this segment. it's called, it's very hard to, like, pronounce, but I'm doing my best. Is the title.
My gay agenda item is just that recording. Yeah. You make that noise.
It is with a host, a web series hosted by Trixie Mattel and Katya, who are both RuPaul's Drag Race alums. And it has been on for a number of years now. A new season just started up, which is why I'm mentioning it now. But it's been on for a number of years, and it is like my favorite, like, I am brain dead, need to watch something hilarious thing that exists in the world. They sort of, describing it is tough because it's so surrealist and kind of madcap, but they simply sit in front of a green screen and have a topic for the series, like dating or pet peeves or broccoli, and then just sort of riff off of each other. And they just have this incredible chemistry, and they riff off of each other, joking and analyzing like aspects of each of those topics for like, you know, 8 to 10 minutes, something like that. And it is just so fucking funny. They are so smart in their own ways. And it's maybe the best thing that's come out of the whole RuPaul's Drag Race universe, extended universe.
That's high praise coming from you.
And we should note that there's like a vigorous cosign from our producer, who is nodding his head and grinning happily. So, I would like to hear you say the name of the show one more time, Brian.
Okay, it's it's spelled UNNHHHH, I think. But you'll find it if you Google something like that. But it is on World of Wonder. It's come from World of Wonder, which is the RuPaul production company, and on YouTube. So if you're looking for some August, you know, binge viewing, I would say start at the beginning and just get into the green screen graphics and the hilarity, because they're excellent.
All right. I'd like to recommend a New York Magazine profile by Molly Fisher. It's a profile of one-time Outward guest, Sarah Schulman. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what she's best known for, her appearance on Outward. Now, she's a longtime AIDS activist and author and teacher. The profile was published in the August 3rd issue of New York Magazine, and it does a beautiful job of unpacking the Schulman coinage, Conflict is Not Abuse, which is the title of her 2016 book. And it became sort of unexpectedly and exceedingly popular as a way of understanding all manner of social and political and politicized conflict that all of us seem to be unendingly embroiled in, especially in the wake of the 2016 election, but also as long as people have been having conflict with one another. So part of the impulse to claim victimhood, according to Schulman, is that in our culture, often you need to be a victim to get care and support. And it's also hard within the current cultural discourse to talk about victims who are also perpetrators of abuse. The book does a much better job of explaining those concepts than I can. But what Fisher does is talk about how these trains of thought and lines of inquiry are the culmination of much of Schulman's life and work as a Jewish lesbian in New York. And, you know, she's done so much and produced so much for the queer community and with the queer community. And it strikes to me a note of optimism, even though I don't know that Sarah Schulman would identify herself as a particularly optimistic person. But just to read about the possibility of reconciliation and resolution of community conflicts is heartening in times like these, quote unquote. So I really hope that the profile is introducing some younger queer and trans people to Schulman's work. I enjoy it so much, in part because I disagree with her sometimes, and she's one of the few people who I can really thoroughly disagree with in a way that feels energizing and generative. I mean, she's just smart as hell and so compelling as a writer and thinker. The profile is called Sarah Schulman's Good Conflict by Molly Fisher, and or just read a bunch of Sarah Schulman's work.
My gay agenda is considerably more lowbrow than I would say both of yours, actually.
Perfect.
But, you know, thinking about Ellen DeGeneres as we were in preparation for this conversation, I was thinking about Ellen's show, which was called Ellen. And I have mentioned before that I have spent this summer retreating into the sitcom. I watched all of Designing Women earlier this year, which was really a gay, talk about gay agenda. Like, that is a show that is really forwarding the gay agenda, really advancing the gay agenda. But earlier this year, I also spoke to the comedian Cole Escola for the Working podcast. And we talked a lot about the influence of the sitcom as a form on the kind of comedy he now performs and writes. And so I have continued to be, I've continued to watch sitcoms that I already know from a point of view of comfort, just sort of leaving it on while I'm trying to do my work or while I'm trying to make my kids dinner for the 78th day in a row. And I have been rewatching shows thinking about gay representation. And it's kind of a fascinating exercise in like rereading our recent past. And right now I am watching 30 Rock, and it is a very interesting revisitation, sort of in the way that a fashion trend from just a couple years ago can feel extremely alien and distant. 30 Rock, as a document of a different time in the culture, feels very alien and distant. And the way the show talks about queerness in particular is extremely almost unrecognizable to me. And it's hard for me to imagine that a contemporary sitcom writer's room would conceive of joking about queerness in the way that 30 Rock did only a handful of years ago. And so I highly recommend the sitcom revisitation project for your waning months of summer. I don't have much left in me intellectually before the cool weather of fall, and so I'm going to finish watching 30 Rock, and then I think I'm actually going to watch Ellen after this and really try and understand what that show was doing before Ellen came out as a part of the storyline, and then after Ellen came out as part of the storyline. It's a part of my history that, like, it's a part of our cultural history that, again, in the way that fashions from a couple years ago can feel really irrelevant, that's sort of the space it seems to occupy for me, but I would like to brush up on that. So I have plenty of time cooking to watch these sitcoms on my iPad and sort of zone out. So that's my plan. That's my gay agenda for the rest of the summer.
Thank you for giving me permission to rewatch Frasier.
Yeah. Oh.
I always need that.
Listen, and again, talk about a text that advances the gay agenda. I mean, Frasier really doesn't get enough credit for doing that work.
Exactly.
Well, that is about it for this month, and in fact, this summer. Please send us your feedback and topic ideas at outwardpodcast@slate.com or via Facebook and Twitter at Slate Outward. Our wonderful producer is Daniel Schrader. June Thomas is the senior managing producer of Slate Podcasts and an unqualifiedly deserving American lesbian icon. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app, tell your friends about it, rate and review the show so that others can find it. Outward will be back in your feeds September 16th. Guys, I'll see you this fall.
See you then, Ramon.
Bye.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.